Hello, everybody. It is Fantai Bridges, and you are listening to Voices for Change. For the past couple of weeks, we have been doing a climate change crash course that provides a foundation on the issue of why you should care. Climate change has the force to alter the Earth system as we know it. And all over the world, countries will experience severe natural disasters, population displacement, and a decrease in public health, among other implications. It has a global impact, but developing countries and vulnerable communities will carry most of the burden, and their challenges will be felt by the rest of the world. It is hard to believe that a crisis so detrimental to the community has not been solved already. And so this week, part three of our three-part crash course, we will be discussing the complexities of addressing climate change and examine the effectiveness of current efforts and initiatives. First and foremost, government and international action is key to solving climate change. However, the nature of climate data makes it difficult for scientists to convince decision makers to move towards greener initiatives and policies. Climate data has to be collected over a long period of time, at least 30 years, for trends to show and impacts to develop. This time range is necessary for scientists as they have to account for the Earth's natural climate fluctuations and the lag time between our actions and activity in the climate's response. However, this lack of immediate evidence and consequences downplay the severity of the issue, especially when we're talking about an invisible force that we cannot see, we can't feel, and we're not going to see it today, we're not going to see it tomorrow. It's going to be in the future. And yes, there are correlations of current natural disasters with climate change, but these claims require a lot of data and credibility to be convincing. And so more often than not, scientists have to rely on prediction models to convey the urgency of this crisis. But estimations have not been enough to convince governments, policymakers, and leaders to transition to greener initiatives and policies. Acknowledging climate change is a daunting task. You're admitting that our society and our lifestyles have shifted the planet that we live on. Forces that seem uncontrollable and deadly are getting worse. Like, who would have thought that our lifestyle could increase hurricanes and droughts? So taking accountability and action requires a lot of change on the government's end. And these changes are investments. These shifts are investments, but they are costly and will change our social, political, and economic systems. And these changes require a lot of reorganization and adaption on the government's end. So these leaders need a lot of empirical data to validate that climate change has to be addressed now. It needs to be worth it. Moving forward, perspectives on preventative measures. Mitigating greenhouse gases and enacting climate policies are preventative measures that governments can implement right now to reduce climate change in the future. However, the enforcement of preventative measures has its challenges. Being proactive to an issue is less glamorous and heroic than combating one in the moment. Michael Wacker in The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore, claims that voters reward politicians for fixing problems, but rarely for preventing them. Preventative measures can seem tedious or unnecessary when the crisis is unprecedented and invisible. Again, we can't see it, we can't smell it, we can't feel it right now, and we probably won't for a couple of years. And the outcome of prevention is just as invisible as the issue itself. If you do things right, it means you're never going to be proven right because you've prevented bad things from happening, said Emily Mazzucarati, founder and CEO of Berkeley-based climate risk analysis firm 24/7. While preventative measures are affordable than responding after the effects happen, it is a lot harder to sell to decision makers. Moving on to the third challenge, global inaction. The regulation of greenhouse gases is complicated to implement as the scale of emissions is enormous, and the sources of these emissions are spread globally. Commitment by individual states is not enough, especially when we consider accountability and transparency. Involvement at the international scale is the only way to effectively reduce these emissions and slow climate change. However, voluntary commitment is very hard to ensure. Self-interest is the main concern that prevents countries from adopting climate policies and renewable energy. Climate policies can be costly to implement and could shift global economies. And the course and magnitude of these shifts cannot be certain, but they do threaten various industries. The fossil fuel industry is extremely lucrative, and that consists of oil and gas. And this industry has been historically known for lobbying against climate policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. These groups go beyond business and have become political forces as well. In some cases, climate change policies are not feasible for countries to enact, especially in developing countries, which is also a cause for inaction. Some countries may have issues that are prioritized higher than reducing greenhouse gas emissions, while others might rely on unsustainable industries for income, for instance, deforestation and lumber. Insufficient resources might also prevent a country from transitioning to climate policies. In a general debate among the UN's Second Committee this past fall, Botswana's delegate stated that the country was currently experiencing a climate change-related drought, which had severely hampered many of the nation's efforts to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. There is also an ongoing debate on the right to develop, which discusses the role of industrialization. Now, many countries have developed at the expense of minorities. And in the context of climate change, developing countries have the right to their economic, social, and cultural development without being penalized for not meeting prevention measures or enacting certain policies. So what now? I think it's clear that strong global coordination, compromise, and organization are necessary for mitigating greenhouse gases, as there are economical, social, political, and moral implications to climate change and the policies to combat it. Collective international cooperation could support and include developing countries. Responsibility and regulations could be proportioned to the financial capabilities of a nation, which would take off the pressures and provide realistic timelines for developing countries to meet their goals. We have seen successful global cooperation in environmental improvement with the Montreal Protocol in 1987. Now, this treaty successfully banned chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, worldwide, which stopped the depletion of the ozone layer. During the time, scientists realized that the ozone layer had a hole in it, so a lot of health issues would have ensued if the depletion continued. According to the UN Environmental Program, the protocol is to date the only UN treaty ever that has been ratified by all 197 UN member states. The Multilateral Fund for the Implementation of the Montreal Protocol ensured full participation by providing financial and technical assistance to developing countries to follow the protocol's control measures. Since the ban of CFCs, the ozone hole is finally healing. The success of the Montreal Protocol is an excellent example of when global climate action and cooperation works. Similar to the Montreal Protocol, we have the Climate Paris Agreement in 2015, which is a universal accord that aims for the mitigation of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. Kenya is one of the 189 states that have ratified this agreement. The agreement follows the intended nationally determined contributions, or INDC, where countries will submit and publish their contributions that are realistic and in context of their national priorities. INDCs allow for conducive and constructive collaboration between national and international decision-making on climate change. And similar to the Montreal Protocol's multilateral fund, the Paris Agreement has a green climate fund which aimed to contribute roughly 10 trillion Kenyan shillings by 2020, although 1 trillion Kenyan shillings has been donated thus so far. The Paris Climate Agreement is fairly new, so its success is still undetermined. What the Paris Climate Agreement can learn from the Montreal Protocol is the necessity of 1. Clear communication and advocacy across the public and scientific sector, 2. Urgent global support and action that meets the demand of the crisis, and 3. Innovation among industries to work harmoniously around and with climate policies. Thank you so much for listening. I'm super happy that we were able to do this little crash course, and we hope that you have grown. Stay tuned next week for another interesting podcast.